waiting for. Your arrival is fortuitous. Very, Kurt thought. Ogata's voice returned over the speakers. We calculate this as a level 3 wave, he said, bearing 245 degrees. Stand by, Kenzo said. He rushed back to his own machine and rotated it carefully, using a large brass lever. It turned smoothly on a pewter gimbal. 260, he said, reading off the bearing marker. Kenzo went to the map and placed the oversized protractor against it. From their current position at the castle, he marked a straight line running 260 degrees. It slashed down the length of Japan, crossed over Nagasaki, and ran out into the ocean. Satisfied with this mark, he located Ogata's position on another part of the island, and then drew a line along the 245-degree bearing. The lines crossed out in the East China Sea. The intersection was nowhere near the edge of the tectonic plate. As far as Kurt could tell, it was solidly up on the continental shelf, no more than 100 miles from Shanghai. Kenzo seemed just as surprised. With the mark in place, he rushed back to the large microphone. Are you certain of those numbers? Please reconfirm. Ogata came back on the line. Stand by for... He was interrupted by a stuttering noise. Was that? Geme said. Gunfire, Kurt said, suddenly on alert. Ogata, are you reading me? Kenzo transmitted. Is everything okay? Thick static came first, and then there are men coming up the hill. They're carrying... Additional gunfire cut him off, but the line stayed open long enough to hear shouting, and then some kind of explosion. Ogata, Kenzo said, clutching the microphone tightly. Ogata! His face went white. His hand began shaking. His stricken appearance told Kurt that this wasn't part of the show. As Kenzo waited for an answer, a deep, somber bell started ringing somewhere high in the castle. The sorrowful tone echoed repeatedly. What's that? Our alarm, Kenzo said. Glass shattered in the atrium behind them. Kurt spun and saw an object crashing through one of the windows and tumbling across the room toward them. Chapter 8. As the glass shattered, Kurt lunged forward, tackling Kenzo over the back of the heavy desk. From the corner of his eye, he noticed Paul and Geme diving for cover. He never saw Joe, who'd stepped in front of the bouncing projectile, caught it bare-handed like a second baseman, and hurled it back in the direction it had come. The grenade made a second hole in the glass and exploded on the far side. An incendiary device. It was powerful enough to kill anyone in close proximity, but designed primarily to spread fire and jellified gasoline. It flared like the sun, shattering every window in the atrium and unleashing a rain of molten liquid and broken glass. As the crystal tones of falling glass subsided, they heard the roar of motorboats on the lake. Almost immediately, sporadic gunshots were fired. Kurt helped their host to a sitting position. Your castle is under siege, Master Kenzo. Why? Kenzo blurted out. By whom? I was going to ask you the same thing. My acolytes will defend us, Kenzo said proudly. The gunfire told Kurt they were going to face a stiff challenge. Only if they've got something better than swords and catapults to fight with. What about this? Joe said, standing by the old Gatling gun. Do you have ammunition for it? A few boxes. Joe released the brake, put his shoulder into the frame, and wheeled the old weapon toward the window. Anything else? Kurt asked. We have a cannon in the tower. That won't be much use against speedboats, Kurt said. Looking around, he spied a crossbow and a flight of iron-tipped darts sitting on a shelf. Get Joe the ammunition, he told Kenzo, and keep your head down. Kurt went to the wall, switched off the lights, and grabbed the crossbow from the shelf. By now, Paul and Geme had reappeared. Paul had a spear in his hand. Geme was holding a mace. There was something wrapped around the handle, but Kurt didn't have time to ask. You two stay here, he said. If things get out of control, make your way to the garage, but don't lower the drawbridge unless you have no other choice. Where are you going? Geme asked. Kurt slung the quiver of darts over his back. to the tower, he said. Someone needs to take the high ground. As Kurt rushed out of the room, Kenzo arrived beside Joe with two boxes of ammunition. Taking cover as random potshots hit around them, Joe opened the boxes. He was happy to see that the shells were modern loads and not the same vintage as the gun. Where did you get these? We had them made by an old gunsmith. Let's hope he does quality work. Joe emptied the box of shells into the hopper, grabbed the crank, and angled the gun downward. Turning the crank with a smooth motion, he got the barrels to rotate. The shells were drawn in, and a half turn later began punching holes in the night. Joe turned the weapon slowly and smoothly, not wanting to use up too much ammunition too quickly. Lower, Kenzo said. Joe tilted the weapon down and fired again, as the entire room filled with a cloud of blue smoke. Kurt was halfway across the parapet when the first stuttering shots from the Gatling gun sounded. Glancing back, he saw gun smoke billowing out of the window. Down below, a spread of bullets stitched a line in the water and across the bow of one of the speedboats. The driver gunned the throttle, turned the wheel, and sped off into the dark. At the same time, another boat moved forward, one gunman on the bow pouring suppressing fire into the atrium while a second man readied a grenade. With sustained cover fire hitting the building, the Gatling gun went silent. Joe had been forced under cover, but Kurt had a shot. He rose up, aimed the crossbow over the wall, and pulled the trigger. The arms of the old weapon snapped forward and the bolt flew with surprising ease, but its feathers were warped from years of sitting around. It went off course, diving and turning like a badly thrown curveball. Instead of hitting the man in the chest, it plunged through his foot. He cried out in pain and dropped the grenade. He stretched for it and shouted, but his foot was nailed to the fiberglass. His shouts were cut off as the boat erupted in flames. Men in one of the other boats spotted Kurt and began firing his way. He dropped down behind the thick embattlements and listened as the shells pinged off the stone behind him. One down, three to go. Joe was on the floor taking cover when the explosion flared outside. He crawled to the window to get a look. The speedboats were making high-speed runs now, strafing the castle walls and peeling back. He manned his gun and tried to hit them, but the old weapon was too heavy and too hard to maneuver to track the boats successfully. He fired, shouldered the gun into a new position, and then fired again. Just as he reached for the second box of ammunition, the last speedboat raced out of view. "Are they moving off?" Kenzo asked. "Not off," Joe said, "to the other side of the island." Almost immediately, the shooting began again, this time from the far side of the castle.
"Now might be a good time to call the authorities," Joe suggested.
"We don't have phones. Use the radio." Kenzo ran over to the old shortwave, tested the microphone, and then switched to a channel used by Japan's emergency services. "This is 7J3 X-ray, X-ray Zulu," he began, using his officially licensed ham radio designation. "Request emergency police assistance. Armed men are attacking us. Repeat, armed men are attacking us." They received no response, nothing but static. "The antenna," Kenzo replied, pointing toward the shattered windows. "It's out there." "Keep trying," Joe said. "We can't hold them off forever." As if to prove the point, a grappling hook flew over the wall and lodged with a metallic clang. Joe realigned the Gatling gun and waited. The hook shimmied back and forth, and a man appeared at the top. He climbed over the wall and crouched as a second man arrived. Joe raised the barrels and pushed the crank forward. The handle moved half an inch, and then jammed. Back and forth didn't free it, and Joe had no idea how to clear the old gun. Out on the wall, two more attackers appeared. "Time to go," Joe said. "We're about to be flanked." Kurt crossed the dry moat and made it back to the main building, where he found a stairway. He rushed up three flights and came up on the third floor of the pagoda.
As he stepped from the shadows, a sword flashed through the air toward his head. He ducked at the last second, and the blade cut a chunk out of the wall behind him. Surging toward the attacker and using the crossbow as a battering ram, he found himself colliding with Akiko. He tackled her to the ground. "Mr. Austin," she said. "Careful where you swing that thing," he said. "I'm sorry," she said. "I thought you were one of them." He let her up, and she stepped back, holding the sword tightly. Kurt noticed she was now wearing a vest of loose metal plates held together by laced twine. "I see you've changed for the occasion." "I am the armorer," she said. "I must protect Kenzo." She went to brush past, but Kurt grabbed her arm. "My friends are with Kenzo. They'll protect him. Take me up to the tower. We need to take the high ground. From there, we can keep their men off the walls." "This way." She turned on her heels, pulled open a door, and dashed up another flight of stairs. Kurt followed, surprised by how quickly she moved in the heavy vest. They reached the top and broke out onto a platform that covered the highest level of the tower. The small anti-personnel cannon was there, along with bags of powder and a neatly packed pyramid of iron cannonballs. As much as Kurt wanted to fire it, the cannon was too bulky to be helpful. He ignored it and stepped to the rail with the crossbow in hand. From this height, he could see most of the castle grounds below. The situation looked grim. "They've made it over the wall," he said, noticing three groups of men moving about. When one group appeared in the open, Kurt loosed a bolt at them, hitting the leader in the thigh. As the man fell, Kurt placed the crossbow on the ground to reload, and Akiko stepped forward with a longbow in her hand. She let the arrow fly and knocked a second man in a flash before adjusting her aim and firing again. Both shots hit their targets. One man fell where he stood. The other dropped his weapon and lumbered for cover as Akiko took aim once more. The third arrow sung as she released it, but the target had ducked behind an outjutting wall and the lethal projectile caromed harmlessly off the stone. Still, he was injured, and that group of attackers would have no choice but to retreat. "Save some of them for me," Kurt joked. She didn't sense the humor. "Unfortunately, we have plenty of enemies left to fight." Seeming to prove the point, an assault rifle began hammering away, shells splintering the wood above them and pinging off the heavy iron bell. Kurt and Akiko dropped to the ground and took cover in the center of the platform as additional gunfire came in from the other side. "We're caught in a crossfire," Kurt said as he crawled toward the rail and risked a look. "They've taken cover behind the wall. Might be time to break out that cannon after all." Before they could do more, a muffled explosion, followed by a whoosh of flames and smoke, rumbled on the far side. "Molotov cocktail," she said.
"Without oysters or caviar," Kurt said. "Just uncivilized."
Down below, tongues of auburn flame licked at the edges of the pagoda and began snaking their way up toward its crown. The ancient wood was bone dry and lacquered in oil-based paint. Dark and noxious fumes billowed upward. The fire would soon follow. "We need to get out of here," Kurt said.
"You said we needed to take the high ground."
"That was before the high ground became a barbecue." Kurt urged her forward, and the two of them ran down the stairs, only to find the door stuck. Kurt put a shoulder to it, but it wouldn't budge.
"There's something up against it," Akiko said, looking through a small window at the top.
Kurt stepped back, preparing to charge forward and hit it like a battering ram. But before he could move, a salvo of bullets punctured the wooden door from the other side. Kurt plastered himself against the stairs and avoided being hit, but Akiko took two shots to the chest and fell backward. Kurt rushed forward, shoved the crossbow through the small window at the top of the door, and aimed it downward before pulling the trigger. A shout of pain came from the other side of the door. It was followed by breaking glass and erupting flames of another Molotov cocktail. Flickering orange light visible through the window told him the room outside was on fire, all the beautiful tapestries and old furniture. Staying low, in case another wave of bullets came through, Kurt crawled to Akiko. She lay on her side, grabbing her midsection.
She wasn't bleeding, and Kurt noticed a web of Kevlar beneath the ancient metal plating.
"I was wondering why you bothered to put that on," he said. "Apparently not all technology is bad."
She forced a painful grin.
"We have to get out. This won't protect us from the smoke.
Can you stand?"
"I think so,"
she said, getting to her feet and then doubling over almost as quickly. She began to cough, and Kurt could feel the irritation building in his own lungs. He needed to find another way out, and he needed to find it fast. He glanced back up the stairs, took a deep breath, and ran into the thickening smoke.
Chapter 9.
"This way," Kenzo urged. "Quickly."
He spoke with nervous energy as he led them through a section of the ancient castle that Joe didn't recognize.
"This isn't the way we came," Joe said.
"Shortcut," Kenzo insisted. "It'll keep us hidden. If they're out there and we're in here, it will be better for us all."
They came to a wooden door that Kenzo opened with an old-fashioned key. It swung outward and then bumped against something. Squeezing through, they found themselves in a rotunda. A body on the ground had stopped the door from opening all the way. Kenzo crouched beside it.
"Ichiro, one of my earliest followers. He left an abusive family to come with me."
Joe reached down and felt for a pulse, but a quick look told him it was too late. Ichiro had been riddled with bullets at close range.
"He's dead," Joe said, "and this means our attackers are obviously inside the castle."
Kenzo nodded. "The question is, how many, and where?" A trail of blood led to a far door.
"Let's not go that way," Geme suggested.
The shooting picked up outside, as if things were reaching a frenzy. The scent of burning wood was growing stronger.
"We can't go back the way we came," Paul said.
A third door in the rotunda stood across from them. The other option was a flight of stairs that wound around the rotunda up toward a small door. Kenzo stood and rushed toward the third door, grabbing the handle and pulling.
"Wait!" Joe called out.
It was too late. Kenzo had already pulled the door open. Pent-up flames and smoke exploded from the hall beyond, bursting forward in a flash as new oxygen rushed into what had been a stagnant, air-deprived hall. The flashover engulfed Kenzo and threw him backward at the same time. He was flung to the floor like a rag doll with his clothes on fire. Joe ripped off his coat and lunged for Kenzo, covering him with the jacket and smothering the flames. Geme helped him put the flames out as Paul slammed the door shut to keep the fire from pouring into the rotunda.
"His face is burned," Geme said, "and his hands. I think his clothes took the worst of it."
Kenzo moaned once or twice, but said nothing.
"He hit his head pretty hard," Joe said. "I think he's unconscious. Let's hope he stays that way until we can get him help."
He picked Kenzo up in a fireman's carry and pointed to the door up above.
"Up the stairs," Joe urged. "It's our only chance."
"We'll be exposed," Geme said, gripping the mace.
"We don't have much choice. We're rats in a burning maze, and Kenzo was the only one who knew the layout."
He urged them to move.
"Make sure the ledge is clear. I'll carry Kenzo."
Paul went up first, with Geme right behind him. They checked the door for heat before they opened it, and went through. Joe followed, with Kenzo over his shoulders. He ducked through the door, careful not to harm Kenzo in the process. Paul and Geme were standing on the parapet, awestruck. The entire pagoda was ablaze, all four levels of the ornate wooden structure alive with flames.
"I hope Kurt's not still in that tower," Geme said.
"He is too smart for that," Paul replied.
"Keep moving," Joe urged. "We need to get to the water."
They pressed on, crossing the bridge headed for the outer wall. As they neared it, the door swung open behind them, and a pair of men came running out.
"They're headed this way," Paul said. "If they spot us, we'll be setting targets down on the rocks."
"We have no other choice," Joe said. "Take Kenzo. Find a place to hide. I'll keep our friends occupied as long as I can."
Paul put down the pike, leaning it against the wall, and took Kenzo from Joe. With the injured man over his shoulder, he followed Geme, picking his way down toward the water's edge. As they left, Joe grabbed the pike, turned around, and crouched in the dark. The pursuers were coming on fast, racing through the smoke across the bridge. They too were escaping the inferno more than anything else, but they wouldn't hesitate to shoot Paul, Gamay, and Kenzo if they found them. Joe wasn't about to let that happen. He stayed hidden, waiting until they were almost on top of him before rising up. He swung the pike in a tight curve. It caught the first man in the stomach, doubling him over. In response, the second man aimed a pistol at Joe, but a return stroke of the metal pike caught the weapon and knocked it from the assailant's hand. The gun fell onto the rocks and discharged harmlessly, but the man lunged for Joe and tackled him. They struggled and then fell over the wall, not forward toward the lake, but backward into the dry moat, where the Komodo dragons waited. Kurt climbed down the stairs with Kenzo's anti-personnel cannon in his arms, eyes burning and half-blind with tears. He almost tripped over Akiko. She was lying on the floor near the gap in the door. A chimney-type effect was bringing fresh air in, funneling it up the stairs, keeping them alive in the process. Kurt exhaled and took a breath as he set the cannon on the floor. Akiko crawled toward him and helped to set it up. They packed it with powder and an 8-pound solid steel cannonball. Unable to find a proper linstock or lighter, Kurt used a wadded-up piece of paper. He touched it to the fire coming down the stairwell and held it against the fuse. For a long couple of seconds, nothing happened. Then the fuse sizzled to life, the powder charge went off, and the 8-pound ball thundered into the door, blasting it to splinters. "And I thought this thing wouldn't be useful," Kurt mused. Shoving broken pieces of wood aside, they enlarged the gap and climbed through, crawling over a pile of furniture that had been used to block them in. "Which way to the garage?" "This way," she said. Despite her bruised ribs and the vest of armor, she moved quickly. They found 7 of Kenzo's people, but no sign of Kenzo or the Numa team. "Is anyone else here?" Akiko asked. One of the men shook his head. "We have to go back," Akiko said. For the second time, Kurt grabbed her by the arm. By now, the smoke was beginning to creep down into the garage. Some of the rafters were smoldering. "The floor above us has to be an inferno. Joe will get them out. Trust me." She shook loose and turned to the others. "Tell them to get in the cars," Kurt said. "We're going to drive out of here." Akiko gave the command in Japanese, then added, "I'll lower the drawbridge." She ran to the wall, pulled one lever to the side, and then down. The drawbridge fell with surprising speed. It banged into place. The bridge beyond was already in flames. Joe and the man who'd tackled him landed in the sand and separated. They got up simultaneously, forgot about their own fight, and focused their attention outward, looking for the Komodo dragons. 2 of the smaller animals were coming at them from one side. A 3rd was holding its ground far beyond, and the 4th, the largest of the group, was lumbering toward them from the other direction. The animals were agitated and far more aggressive than any Joe had seen before. The fire, smoke, and cinders probably had something to do with that. One of the smaller ones came forward, and Joe stood as tall as he could, raising his arms in a sudden motion. The predator stopped in its tracks, dropping lower to the ground on its oddly bent legs. It moved again, and Joe repeated the motion, but the animal seemed less impressed. "Where's your gun?" Joe shouted. The assassin looked at Joe oddly before shoving him to the ground and running for the wall. Joe leapt to his feet, flung some of the gravel at the dragons, and dashed for the pike he'd been using. He quickly grabbed it from the ground, spun, and swiped the first animal in the face. The beast hissed and backed away. Meanwhile, Joe's assailant was running for his life. His movement had attracted the attention of the largest dragon in the moat. The 10-foot-long, 300-pound monster moved with surprising speed. The man sprinted without looking back, leapt into a gap in the wall, and scrambled upward. The Komodo dragon rushed up behind him, reared up on its back legs, and thrust its head into the gap. It managed to rake its teeth along his shoulder and arm, tearing the man's shirt off and gouging some of his flesh. It came down with the back of the man's shirt in its mouth, but had missed out on a meal. The man kept climbing, his bare back displaying a colorful tattoo that covered every inch of skin. Joe felt a begrudging respect as the man reached the top of the wall and disappeared over it. But he was now alone with four of the most lethal animals in the world.
"I'd like to see them eat," Joe whispered, recalling his words from an hour ago. "Why do I say these things out loud?"
The animals moved toward him. As Joe saw it, the big one was the problem. The others were small enough to ward off with the long metal spear, but the big one would probably yank it out of his hand and use it as a toothpick once it devoured him. He tried to outflank it, but it blocked him and forced Joe to back up. A thunderous crash startled all of them, and Joe turned to see a section of the burning pagoda tumble into the moat. A shower of sparks sent the lizards back a few yards.
"Not the kind of dragons that like fire," Joe mused.
He moved toward the flames, pulled his coat off, and wrapped it around a burning length of wood. With the pike in one hand and the flaming torch in the other, he inched toward the waiting animals. "Back," he said, jabbing at the nearest one. "Back!" The dragon swatted at the stick with an outstretched claw, but retreated after making contact with the flames. The other juvenile did the same, but the alpha male stood its ground.
"Now or never," Joe told himself.
He rushed directly toward the big animal, tossing the blazing section of wood at its face. The animal shrugged off the burning stick, knocking it effortlessly to the side with its snout. The distraction was all Joe needed. Still running, he jammed the pike into the sand and pole-vaulted himself up and over the animal, launching himself forward at the top and hitting the ground at a dead run. The beast leapt up too late to swat him out of the sky. It came back down on all fours and spun in a half-circle. Joe was already leaping onto the wall. He found the cleft and climbed hand over hand, never looking back until he reached the top. The Komodo dragon stood below in a tight semicircle, gazing up at him hungrily. Joe waved a farewell and ran down toward the lake, where Paul, Gamay, and Kenzo were taking cover on the rocks. There was no sign of his wounded attacker. Out on the water, the boats were speeding off into the dark. "They're leaving," Paul said. "The question is, who are they and why did they do this?" Gamay asked. "Whoever they are, they've done what they came to do," Joe said. "They've burned Kenzo out and destroyed his work. All the data, all the records, it's all on paper. Everything is gone."
"Not everything," Gamay said.
Joe turned her way. She unraveled what she'd wrapped around the shaft of the mace. It was the blue map with the silver borders. Aside from torn patches in each corner where she'd ripped it from the wall, it was no worse for wear. The red lines were still plainly visible. "Someone didn't want us to find out where these lines crossed," Gamay said. "I thought that made this information worth saving."
"Could it really be worth killing for?" Paul asked.
"Someone obviously thought so," Joe said, looking at Kenzo.
"How is he?"
"He's coughing blood," Gamay replied. "I think his lungs may have been burned. If he inhaled the fire..."
She didn't have to say any more. They all knew that to be a bad diagnosis. In any case, Kenzo's only hope was a hospital with a burn center. "We could use a car," Paul said. "Any chance the garage hasn't burned?" Joe looked over his shoulder, though he didn't need to. The entire pagoda was an inferno. It no longer looked like a building, just a fountain of flame. "Not likely," Joe said, "but this fire should act as a beacon and bring help. It couldn't be much brighter." A minute later, the sound of another boat motoring through the darkness set everyone on edge. Joe strained to see into the night. Instead of a sleek motorboat, he saw a slow, ungainly-looking craft chugging their way. Its flat front bulldozed the water rather than knifing through it, while its motor sounded like an old air-cooled VW. "The Duck," Joe said, recognizing the amphibious car from Kenzo's collection. Kurt was at the wheel, while Akiko and several of Kenzo's people were sitting in the back. Joe waved frantically to get Kurt's attention. The Duck wouldn't be the fastest mode of transportation, but it could drive on land as well as water. It meant there was a chance to get Kenzo help.
Chapter 10 Shinjuku Prince Hotel. After spending the balance of the night at the hospital and talking with the local police, Kurt, Joe, Paul, and Gamay had been taken to a hotel, where they'd managed a few hours of exhausted sleep, before talking with Rudy Gunn in Washington. The tone of the conversation was somber until Kurt asked Rudy's permission to sneak into Chinese waters and see what they might be hiding. "Not a chance," Rudy Gunn replied. "Absolutely out of the question." His voice came from the speakerphone sitting in the middle of the table. The sound was surprisingly clear, echoing around the hotel suite with so much volume that Rudy might as well have been there in person. Kurt leaned back in his chair, his eyes on the triangle-shaped speaker. "So what I'm hearing is you'd like us to be careful." "Then you need to get your ears checked," Rudy said. "The location you gave us is not just deep within Chinese territorial waters, in a section they've designated a special operations zone. It's one of their naval testing grounds. They patrol the demarcation line relentlessly. Ships, aircraft, submarines. They even have a permanent line of tethered sonar buoys out there. Something like our SOSIS lines in the North Sea." Kurt looked around at the others. After what they'd just been through, every one of them wanted to get a look at whatever Kenzo and his analog machines had found. Paul took the next crack at it. "Rudy, I've gone over what I know of Kenzo's theory. Geologically speaking, there's a reasonable chance he's onto something. Considering the situation, there has to be some method of sneaking us in there." "That's not like you, Paul. How bad is Kurt twisting your arm?" "Only a minor sprain," Paul said, tongue-in-cheek. "Help us, and no one gets hurt," Kurt joked. Joe offered a thought. "We could have a commercial vessel wander off course, break down and request our help. Maybe even stage a fire or some other urgent need. We've done it before. If we happen to be the closest vessel, then you'd already be in Chinese waters," Rudy said. "Look, it's simple. The Chinese don't need our help to rescue anyone that close to their own shoreline, and they're not too keen on anyone wandering into their waters or airspace. A few years ago, they crashed into one of our surveillance planes, and that flight was still technically in international airspace." Kurt sat back. "What if we hitchhiked aboard one of the Navy's new attack subs?" Kurt said. "I've heard they're undetectable." "Already asked," Rudy replied. "So far, the only thing undetectable has been an official response to my request. Apparently, the Navy isn't interested in sending their newest submarine into a shallow water sea filled with China's most sophisticated underwater listening posts. And I can't blame them." Kurt looked up. Had Rudy just given something away? "You've already asked the Navy for help? What gives?" The room went silent. And when Rudy spoke again, his voice was slightly less authoritative. "Would you believe I've come to trust your judgment? Not in a million years." Rudy sighed audibly. "Let's put it this way. Our government hasn't detected any of these Z-waves like your new friend. But over the past 2 years, both NUMA and the Navy have picked up subsurface reverberations coming from that very section of the East China Sea, where those Z-wave paths crossed. Putting two and two together, it raised the possibility of there being something worth investigating." "So Kenzo was right," Paul said. "There is something going on out there. What kind of noise are we picking up?" "It's been impossible to classify," Rudy told them. "Possibly deep-sea drilling, but there are enough differences in the acoustic signatures to make us wonder. Some of the Navy's data has been identified as liquid movement within the continental plate itself." "Oil?" Joe asked. "That's one possibility," Rudy said. "Both the East and South China Seas are riddled with hydrocarbon deposits, and the Chinese have been very aggressive in staking their claim, especially in the South China Sea where they've drawn that infamous 9-dashed line. Except the location Kenzo identified is in the East China Sea. Far enough behind the established border that it's unquestionably under Chinese control." "No need to drill in secret if you're drilling on your own territory," Gamay said. We looked at a subsurface drilling arrangement 2 years ago, Paul said. The geology team liked the idea. The accounting department had a different perspective. Nearly 100 times as costly as setting up a normal rig. Makes no sense to do something like that where you don't have to.
Exactly, Rudy replied. Beyond that, the sonar recordings don't match with any known drilling or extraction techniques. Some of the data indicates free-flowing liquid moving extremely fast under intense pressure, much lighter and less viscous than crude oil. Meanwhile, a second set of echoes registers something far thicker and slower. It's also coming from far deeper, down within the continental plate itself, deeper than anyone has ever drilled. Paul offered an explanation. If it is subsurface magma, that might indicate a range of volcanic islands building out there.
It could be exactly what we're looking for.
Except that we're back at square one since we have no way of investigating, Joe said. Gamay leaned forward. I hate to be the voice of reason, but you guys seem intent on sneaking around and doing things the manly way. Why don't we try a female perspective and a little cooperation? We could just ask the Chinese to let us take a look. We could give them the data on the sea level rise, explain that there's a possibility that a new island chain is forming off their coast, or that a bulge in the tectonic plate is occurring, and ask them to share in our investigation. They might even appreciate it.
One thing Kurt had always liked was the team's differing approaches to problem solving. Good idea, Kurt told her, but not in this case. We were all viciously attacked last night, and 5 of Kenzo's people are dead. Kenzo is in the hospital fighting for his life. For all his quirks, the only thing his research threatened was exposing something going on in Chinese waters. So until it's proven otherwise, we have to assume the Chinese were behind the attack. Gamay nodded.
They're hiding something out there, Kurt added.
Whatever it is. They're not going to show it to us willingly. We'll have to find another way.
And I'm telling you it's impossible, Rudy said. I'll send you the data on the Chinese listening posts, sonar buoys, and what we know about their patrol schedules and surveillance capabilities. You'll see for yourself. It's a very tight screen and there's no way to get through. The last thing we need is an international incident that ends up with any of you rotting in a Chinese jail.
Kurt listened to every word and nodded at Joe. Message received. The sound of papers shuffling came next. I have another meeting to attend, Rudy added. I'll check back in a few hours. Rudy signed off, and Kurt stood. The others were yawning, but he was suddenly wide awake. A knock at the door followed. Kurt answered it, and found the front desk manager standing there with a message in his hand.
What is it?
Summons of sorts, Kurt said. Our presence is requested at the district office of the Japanese Federal Police.
I'm suddenly tired, Joe quipped. Think I'll take a nap instead.
Kurt shook his head. Sorry, amigo, but you're the main attraction. They want to talk to you about the guy who escaped being a meal for the Komodo dragon. You're the only one that got a look at him.
Joe stretched. I suppose I could recount how I fought the great beast.
Kurt rolled his eyes as Gamay stood and yawned.
The long flight has caught up to me.
Me too, Paul said. We'll rest while you talk to the police.
Sorry,
Kurt said. No rest for the weary. You need to start right now.
Doing what?
Gamay asked. Finding a way to sneak into the East China Sea. Paul cocked his head to the side. Gamay's eyebrows knitted together in a confused look.
But Rudy just told us not to try that,
Gamay replied. I believe his exact words were completely out of the question, Paul seconded. His lips said no, but his eyes said yes, Kurt replied.
You couldn't see his eyes.
I could imagine them, Kurt insisted. Why do you think he's sending over all the data on the Chinese naval patrols and the information on the sonar buoys? He wants us to find a crack in the armor and exploit it.
Gamay folded her arms across her chest.
That is not what I got out of that conversation.
There's listening, and then there's understanding, Kurt said. This was an open line. Anyone could be eavesdropping.
Check your encrypted email link in a few minutes. If there's nothing from Rudy, feel free to nap the afternoon away. But I think you'll be working. Gamay and Paul rose wearily. Joe yawned again and stretched in an effort to shake off the drowsiness. Kurt opened the door and held it for him. My long nap on the plane isn't appearing so crazy now, is it?
Chapter 11. Metro Police Station. The note from Superintendent Nagano requested Kurt and Joe take an odd route to the police station. After riding two different trains, hailing a taxi and taking a short walk, they stood outside the prefecture building. Not exactly the 12th precinct, Joe said. The structure was nothing like the typical American police station. The outer walls were painted in a rainbow of pastel colors, while an officer in full dress uniform and white gloves stood at attention near the main entrance. He held a polished wooden staff firmly in his right hand, and neither blinked nor seemed to breathe as people walked past. Ritsuban, Kurt said, standing guard, letting the public know that the eyes of the police are always watching. That's reassuring, Joe said. Apparently not to Master Kenzo. They entered the building and found themselves in a diamond-shaped room with two doors leading in and two leading back out to the street. Expecting a duty officer, Kurt and Joe found only screens and a computer voice talking in Japanese. Kurt stepped up to one of the flat screens. It reminded him of the arrivals and departures monitors in the airport, except everything was in Japanese. Can't read a thing. Joe tapped a spot on the screen and was rewarded with the option to change languages. Two versions of English were listed, American and UK. Joe tapped on the American flag icon. Welcome to the Yamana Police Station, the computer voice said in English. Please state your reason for arrival. We have a 2 o'clock meeting with Superintendent Nagano, Kurt said. Please state your name and nationality while looking at the camera. Kurt Austin, American. Joe Zavala, American. Silence followed. Hiram would love this, Joe whispered. He and Max could double date out here. Hiram Yeager was Numa's resident computer genius. He'd designed some of the most advanced computer systems the world had ever seen. Max was his finest creation. Built on the fastest processors and operated by special programming Hiram had created himself, Max was a unique machine with true artificial intelligence, an active mind, and even a sense of humor. A pleasant chime sounded, and the door to the right of them opened. Assistant Superintendent Nagano has confirmed your appointment. Please enter. Kurt and Joe walked up three steps and found themselves in a bustling room filled with men and women watching screens and tapping away at computer consoles. The design was open and modern. Stainless steel accents and pinpoint lighting had been used to great effect. Kurt saw no dirt or grime, no tattered mug books, grimy fingerprint stations, or crowded holding cells. Nor did he see any criminals, which wasn't a surprise, since Japan's crime rate was the lowest in the industrialized world, partly because the nation was so wealthy, partly due to effective policing, but mostly because the collective Japanese sense of order remained a pervasive influence. Aside from a few glances, the staff ignored them, until a Japanese man wearing black slacks, a crisp white shirt, and a thin gray tie came over to meet them. Tall, a highly trained triathlete, the man had a wide face with a distinct line around his mouth and a cleft in his chin. His hair was short, thick, and black. I'm Superintendent Nagano, the man said. Kurt bowed slightly, but Nagano shook his hand instead. His grip was solid steel. It is an honor to meet both of you, Nagano replied. Please, follow me. He led them back to a small office that was modern to a fault. At his urging, Kurt and Joe sat down. This is easily the finest police station I've ever been in, Joe said. No, no, Nagano replied. It requires much work to bring it up to standards, but we're doing the best we can. Joe looked around, searching for a flaw.
Kurt would explain later that the Japanese sense of humility required they not take a compliment unless they had achieved perfection. That said, Joe wasn't wrong. The building was a work of art, the interior a high-tech wonderland. Every surface was polished and gleaming. Even the rack of weapons they'd passed as they neared Nagano's office had been lit like a display case at an upscale gun show. "Your foyer was interesting," Kurt said. "Wouldn't it be easier to have a receptionist or a duty officer?" "Easier, perhaps," Nagano said, "but a waste of manpower. As you probably know, Japan's population is shrinking. By automating the arrival phase, we avoid wasting an officer's time that can be better spent elsewhere." "What about the Ritsuban?" Nagano shrugged at the contradiction. "That falls under the category of crime prevention," he said, "though many stations are looking to end the practice or replace the guard with an automated mannequin." "And the world will be all the poorer for it," Kurt said. "At least your automated receptionist spoke different languages," Joe said, still trying to be complimentary. "A necessity," the superintendent replied. "As everyone knows, most of the crime in Japan is caused by foreigners." Kurt noticed the slightest hint of a smile on Nagano's face. An inside joke, most likely. Joe didn't have an answer for that. "Anyway," he said finally, "it's a pleasure to be here." "Thank you," Nagano replied. "Now I must ask you to leave immediately." "Excuse me?" Kurt replied. "You must leave Japan on the first flight out," Nagano insisted. "We will escort you and your friends to the airport." "Are you deporting us?" Kurt asked. "It's for your own safety," Nagano said. "We've identified the men who attacked your group last night. They were once Yakuza hitmen, heavies, and assassins." After hearing Joe's description of the man who'd been mauled by the dragon, Kurt was not surprised. He knew the Yakuza favored wild tattoos. But he posed the obvious question. Why would the Yakuza be interested in the research of an eccentric scientist? "Former Yakuza," Nagano reiterated. "A breakaway group." "In other words," Kurt said, "hired guns." Nagano nodded. "Once, in our past, there were Ronin. That is the name for a samurai without a lord. They lived as nomads, as warriors for hire. These men are similar. They are killers without a master, working for whom they please. They were once bonded to particular Yakuza organizations, but years ago we managed to break up many of the criminal networks. The leaders were sent to prison or killed, but the lower-level members were only scattered and left to their own devices. Now they answer to no one but themselves. In many ways, they're more dangerous now than before." "Any idea who they're working for?" Nagano shook his head. "No doubt they were hired for a rather large fee. Their number and the brazen method of attack suggest that much. But who paid them and why? We haven't the slightest lead." Kurt knew it had something to do with the East China Sea and the disturbance that Kenzo had detected there, but without more information, guessing was pointless. "The fact of the matter is," Nagano continued, "you and your friends thwarted the attack. Retribution can be expected." "From whoever paid these Ronin," Joe said. "Or from the hitmen themselves," Nagano said. "You've embarrassed them, shamed them. They will want to save face." "So much for foreigners committing all the crimes in Japan," Kurt said. "Sadly, yes." Nagano pushed a file folder toward Joe. "You're the only person who got a close look at any of them. It would help us if you could look at these pictures." Joe took the file folder and opened it up. Instead of mugshots or surveillance photos, he saw colorful designs drawn on the outline of a man's back and shoulders. "Yakuza are known for extensively inking their skin," Nagano said. "Certain groups use specific designs like a brand. Do you recognize any of these?" Kurt looked over Joe's shoulder at the designs. Each tattoo was intricate and different. Some had wings and dragons, others fire and skulls. One was kaleidoscopes of color and bladed weapons. "Not this one," Joe said, discarding the first sheet of paper. "Or these." He leafed through several additional pages and then stopped. "This is the pattern," he said. "A perfect match for the guy who escaped the dragon pit, minus a good chunk of skin now."
Nagano took the paper.
"As I thought," he said. "Ushione, the demon."
"The demon?" Joe asked.
"His real name is unknown," Nagano said. "In our mythology, the word oni means demon. An Ushione is a particular monster with the head of a bull and fearsome horns. When he first began killing for hire, this man would draw a symbol representing that particular monster using the victim's blood. Unlike most in the syndicates, he actually takes pleasure in killing. Pleasure, and large sums of cash."
"Fantastic," Kurt said. "Now that you know who he is, you can go round him up and we won't have to leave."
Nagano put the drawing aside. "I wish it were that simple. These men are whispers on the wind, impossible to track, let alone capture. We have been chasing Ushione for years."
"Komodo dragons are poisonous," Joe said. "Considering the bite this guy took, I'd say a hospital or the morgue would be his next stop."
"The Komodo is poisonous," Nagano agreed. "But we spoke to an expert this morning. We've been told the lizard does not inject its venom with every bite. A slashing attack, as you saw, would not likely be fatal."
"What about the Komodo dragon's reputation for bad oral hygiene?" Kurt said. "As I recall, they have countless strains of bacteria on their teeth."
"Yes," Nagano said, "and most likely Ushione is battling infection and fever. But given high doses of antibiotics, he would probably survive. Which means you and your friends remain in danger, as I explained to begin with."
Kurt sat back. The issue had an obvious solution. One Nagano probably had in mind, or he wouldn't have asked them to come down to the station.
"The danger would be eliminated if we helped you put him away."
Nagano did not immediately reply.
"That's why you had us take such an odd route to the station," Kurt said. "To make sure we weren't followed."
The superintendent offered a slight bow.
"You're very astute. And, fortunately, you weren't. At least not by anyone but my most trusted officers."
"So let us help you," Kurt said.
"And how do you propose to do that?"
It was obvious to Kurt. As you pointed out, this was a big operation. Several boats, at least a dozen men and plenty of weapons, including incendiary grenades. A job like this would cost a small fortune. And despite the saying there's no such thing as honor among thieves, criminals don't trust criminals, which means no one gets paid till the job is done. At least not the full price. Nagano's face tightened in thought. The line around his mouth deepened.
"You're suggesting we look for a payoff?"
Kurt leaned back in his chair. "Something I'm sure you've already considered."
"Of course we have," Nagano said, his mind obviously running the scenario. "But how are you able to help?"
"Move Kenzo and the other survivors to a safe house. Announce to the media that he's died from his injuries. You could mention that two or three of the Americans have also died and that the others are in critical condition. No need to give out names. The numbers will suffice."
"And then?"
"I can't say for certain," Kurt insisted, "but if I was a former Yakuza hitman, nursing a Komodo dragon bite and pumping high-powered antibiotics into my arm every 4 hours, I'd demand the rest of my payment."
Nagano finished the thought. "And with the balance of payments due, the demon will have to come out of hiding to collect."
"Exactly," Kurt said.
"What if they pay by check?" Joe suggested, only half-joking. "Or electronically?"
"Too large a sum," Nagano said. "They would never risk a government clearinghouse intercepting their money and tracing it. These types of things are done in person. It will happen somewhere very public to ensure that neither side commits an act of violence. That is the way."
Kurt finished the idea.
"If you can find out where that transfer will happen, we'd be glad to show up, point out the demon, and leave the rest to you."
Nagano looked to Joe. He was the one who'd seen him up close.
"Absolutely," Joe said. "It would be a pleasure."
Nagano weighed the offer silently, Finally, he nodded. Reputations for bravery precede you both. Your actions last night live up to them.
Not bravery, Kurt said. Just doing what anyone would, given the situation.
You deflect a compliment well, Nagano replied. How very Japanese. Nevertheless, despite your bravery, I struggle to find a reason you would deliberately put yourselves at risk this way. I hope it's more than just bravado.
For starters, we don't take kindly to being attacked, Kurt began. There's also the possibility that our arrival triggered this. You want the demon for your reasons. We want to know who paid him and why.
You mean your government wants to know?
That too. Nagano was an old hand. He took the measure of people quickly. He understood Kurt and Joe. He felt they were cut from the same cloth as he. Tireless government servants who preferred to get things done rather than wait for the bureaucracy to grind to life. The superintendent straightened some papers on his desk.
Agreed, he said, but I must inform you, it won't be all falsehoods. Unfortunately, Kenzo Fujihara died this morning without ever regaining consciousness. His lungs were burned beyond repair.
Kurt set his jaw. He'd been expecting that.
Damn, Joe whispered.
Kurt looked from Joe to Nagano. Can you put the rest of his people somewhere safe in case this demon of yours decides he hasn't finished the job?
I already have, Nagano said. There is one fly in the ointment, as you Americans like to say.
What's that?
Kenzo's man-at-arms. Or, more precisely, his woman-at-arms.
Akiko, Joe said, perking up. I was hoping we'd see her again. Is she here?
That's just it, Nagano explained. She's vanished.
She was at Kenzo's bedside when he passed away. She seemed particularly grief-stricken, but she left before we could get a statement. That seemed suspicious, so we took her fingerprints off of the weapon she carried. And as it turns out, Akiko has a long criminal record, several outstanding warrants, and links to the Yakuza in Tokyo.
And she seemed like such a nice girl, Joe said. Do you think she was involved?
We can't rule it out, Nagano said.
I can rule it out, Kurt said. Not the way she fought for Kenzo. She took two bullets that would have killed her if she wasn't wearing a vest.
I can only tell you what the record shows, Nagano explained. She's something of a ghost herself. She grew up orphaned, a street urchin who learned to survive by breaking the rules. Unfortunately, that type of life often leads to the criminal underworld.
Or to a new life for the strong.
Perhaps, Nagano said, then added sternly, if she contacts you, I expect to be told.
She won't contact us, Kurt said. She wouldn't have disappeared if she were going to do that. But if I'm wrong and she does reach out, you'll hear about it. You have my word.
Very well, Nagano said. I'll put the word out to my informants. If fortune is with us, something will turn up, and we'll both get what we're after.
Chapter 12. Southwest of Tokyo. The white shape flashed across the countryside in a howling blur. It entered a tunnel, moving like a gigantic snake. It came out the other side, preceded by an earth-bound thunderclap, known as a tunnel boom. Gamay sat by a window in the 8th car of a 12-car train. Despite the speed and noise outside, the cabin was quiet and the ride exceedingly smooth.
I'm glad to be getting out of Tokyo, she said, especially after what Kurt told us.
Sitting next to her, Paul craned his neck around to see if anyone was in earshot. The Tokaido Shinkansen rail line was the original bullet train route in Japan, and though it was the most heavily used high-speed rail line in the world, the premium car in the off-hours express had plenty of unfilled seats to offer.
Couldn't agree more, he replied. On the other hand, Rudy wasn't joking when he said getting past the Chinese patrols would be almost impossible. Look at this.
Paul had a notebook computer open on the tray table in front of him. He'd spent half the ride studying the information Rudy sent. He turned it her way.
Gamay adjusted the angle of the screen and found herself looking at a map of the East China Sea. Curving lines looped here and there, representing the timing and routes of Chinese naval vessels. Broad swaths were marked in gray, indicating the